Welcome to the XYZ Experiment. Today we are joined in the studio by Mitchell and Jack. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
And we are joined on Zoom from Tasmania by Luke.
Hello.
And obviously I'm Dash. We're going to have a chat about relationships and being pregnant and childbearing in the modern age. In today's age. Mm. Yes.
What is that?
And so to begin, we ask all of our guests to tell a little bit about themselves. So over to you both, Mitchell and Jack.
Okay. Well, my name's Jackie. I am 34 years old and currently on maternity leave.
Woohoo!
With our second baby on the way and very much ready for the baby to come out.
Because how many weeks are you?
37 weeks.
Yeah.
So I feel any day now we'll be gifted with another one.
Yay. And Mitchell?
And you forgot what you do for work, which everyone always finds interesting.
It is pretty interesting. I do work with dogs. And sadly, I was very sad to go on maternity leave because I love my job, but I guess I have to look after my body now, unfortunately. Yeah.
And Luke's facial expression was just like, oh, so you didn't know that about Jack?
Yeah, I'm a crazy dog lady.
No, that is such a cool job. Oh, my gosh.
When you say you work with dogs, where do you work with dogs? What kind of organisations do you or have you worked in?
So I've worked in shelters. One of the most interesting one was a seized facility, so court hold dogs. That was very intense, but I had to give that one up. It was a bit emotionally taxing.
Yeah.
But yeah, dogs are just, there's no judgment from them.
And you have a beautiful manner, because my dog Pete Uncle, who is incredibly bossy and sassy, absolutely adores you, like melts. So
what can I say?
And Mitchell?
Less of an exotic job. I work with Dash and Luke at Monash University, and we work with a whole bunch of great people on a bunch of great projects that look at different aspects of human life and health and well-being. Like Jackie said, we have a 2.5-year-old who is keeps us very busy, and another one that hopefully should arrive in the next 2 to 3 weeks for Jackie's sake.
And you also have a fur baby.
We also both forgot our poor firstborn. He's the size of a horse. He's a big ridgeback. His name's Alfie, and he just had his 7th birthday.
Another staple question of the podcast is to ask any of our guests, what generation are you, and what is the trait that you have that is most aligned with your generation?
We actually had to Google what generation we were last night. we are Gen Y. And I would like to say we are a bit tech savvy, but...
You are. I'm probably not so tech savvy. But we do, on the table in front of us, both have a keep cup with coffee. We're Melbourne and Gen Y, so we always have coffee with us. When we were looking up what is characteristics of Gen Y, we also sort of came across a lot of stuff that talks about being socially minded and socially conscious, and we I think we would like to consider ourselves social justice warriors. We used to open our house up to asylum seekers who had sort of no accommodation or work rights or Medicare access and things like that for a while. Jackie's also done a lot of volunteering with animals.
We also do love R&B Fridays. We're a bit old school.
Who's your favourite R&B artist?
Oh, I'd have to say Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's my homeboy.
Amazing.
I think the other thing that we came across, Jack, was the flexible working environments. But that's a very Gen Y thing.
Yes.
Because that's kind of core to how we run our household and how we parent, is that we really value the flexibility and the being able to, you know, each have a work life and a home life and, not be too consumed by any one part of that.
Well, that's a good snapshot. Is there anything that you, when you were Googling about Gen Y, that you were like, that is so not us?
No, but I think a lot of them just seemed like normal personal traits. So we're like, yeah, I guess, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was tricky to determine which ones are actually Gen Y things, yeah, and which ones are could be said of any generation, really, and more just personality differences.
I'm going to go to you, Jack. How long have you and Mitchell been together? Well, how did you guys meet?
We both have different stories, but they always kind of merge together. We were 19. We were working in a restaurant together on the peninsula, just as friends. And then I guess one night I got a very big drunk message from Mitchell while I was working. And yeah, I guess it kind of took off from there. But I did make him work for it. I wanted to make sure he was the real deal. And he was the real deal because we've been together for 14 years. And yeah, it was the best drunk message I've ever received.
Wow.
Pretty uncharacteristic of you, right? Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of... This is what Jackie's was trying to say, that we tell different versions of this story because there was a lot more to it. We had a long friendship, basically, first. We'd been working together for a long time, just as friends. We then had a work party, as all good stories begin with, and that was the point where I realised that I had feelings for her, but it took her a lot longer. And so that's what she means by it. I had to work for it because she was sort of hung up on someone else and still getting over him. And so I had to be patient. And then she decided to tell me that she had feelings for me as well when I was, I think, about 28 days away from moving overseas for 6 months.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Great timing, I think.
I just had to make sure that you were the real deal.
But, Jackie, did you know, like, did you suspect Mitchell liked you?
Not at all.
Really?
I just thought he was, my gosh, he's a really good guy, really good friend.
Sorry, I just wanted to hear the ending of, so 28 days out from going overseas.
Little cliffhanger, left you hanging.
Yeah, getting that response, how did that make you feel? And then did you still end up going overseas? Was it long distance? What happened?
Yeah, I was quite annoyed, I must admit. I had kind of gotten to the point where all our mutual friends had been saying, look, I think she likes you too. She's talking about you a lot. Like, she's interested. And they'd been saying that for months and nothing was happening. And I got to the point where I was like, well, if she turns around and says to me, I like you too, well, I'll say too bad. I'm going away now. Like, I'll be tough. And then she told me that she had feelings for me too, and I kind of just like, okay, I love you. Melted. And then we stayed together, yeah, and Jackie actually came over to visit me in Canada for her 21st birthday.
Maybe we were 20.
Maybe okay. We were 20.
You were 19, I was 20.
I was okay. 19, you were 20. You came to visit me for your 21st birthday, and we stayed in Whistler for 3 nights.
Wow.
Spent 2 weeks travelling around Vancouver. And got home and it was as if we'd been together the whole 6 months. We kind of then pretty much moved into together not long after that.
Yeah. Mm.
Do you feel like it was helpful that you had been friends for so long before that had happened, before the defining the relationship happened?
Definitely, because, yeah, I got to see all different sides of Mitch and I liked them all and I just knew he was real and...
So
yeah,
sweet.
I think for me, more than anything, I'm just not good at dating and not good at trying to make an impression. So when you've got a friendship with someone first, they already know who you are. So you start dating and you're already more comfortable because you're not trying to be, yeah, on.
I like that story because it's so different to like what we're hearing a lot now, which is like people meeting online and stuff like that.
I couldn't date in this day and age.
Yeah, we would be crazy cat people, I reckon.
You'd be a crazy dog person.
Oh, yes, 100%.
So you started dating. How long did you guys date for?
6 years.
Yeah.
Yes. And in that time, we did lots of traveling. Pretty much planned to proposed not long after that.
There doesn't have to be like an answer. It could just be it was a feeling or it just kind of happened. But I'm just curious, you dated for quite a while. You'd spent a long portion of your lives together. What kind of made you decide that marriage was the next step? And at that specific time as well.
We always knew that we were going to get married. I always knew that we would grow old together. Well, we will be growing old together. When you're getting closer to 30, I feel like it's kind of like, okay, you need to look at what's ahead. Marriage first, then children, buying a house. Yeah, I feel like it's definitely an age thing.
That's what we're told we have to do.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I think we probably, to be honest, a lot of our friends got married earlier, and like Jackie said, I think we knew we were going to end up together, so there wasn't this rush to make it official. I think we wanted to travel.
Yes. Mm.
We wanted to have experiences first, because then to us, you know, based on what society says, marriage was then the start of like, okay, putting on our big boy and big girl pants and starting to like settle down. And so let's do all the things that we want to do first, and then whatever money's left over we can spend on a wedding.
It's an interesting conversation that, and good question, Luke, because I know as a geriatric millennial or Gen Y, there was a point that my friendship group were talking about, do you have kids young and then travel as when they're older and you're older, or do you travel first and then have kids later? And it became like this big conversation as to what decision to make. And I would say I can like draw a line down my friendship group of those who traveled first and then had kids later and got married later, and those who have waited. It's kind of an interesting conversation I think our generation had the opportunity to have, which maybe previous generations may not have had that opportunity.
Yeah, I think we probably started to think about whether what society was telling us was something we had to do, or whether we could maybe choose our own adventure a little bit.
But we also knew that we wanted to do as much travelling as possible, because we're very much into culture, and to be honest, bringing children along and missing out on, you know, seeing historical sites and museums was not something that we wanted to miss out on. So, yeah, I think travelling was a big part for us that we both wanted to get out of the way first. We still have done a little bit of travelling with our firstborn. Obviously, it's a lot of baby chinos and playground time, but we got anyway. Everything out that we needed to when we were overseas before we got married.
I think it's really interesting and commendable, your relationship with each other, because I feel as though I'm kind of getting now mid to late 20s, so I'm starting to see this pattern in my own friendship groups where I feel as though there are a lot of couples that do share that comfort that you mentioned with their partners, where they think, irrespective of labels, we're going to be together, whether we get married tomorrow or in 10 years. But there is still that conflict with society and cultural norms. And I wanted to ask you whether or not you found in your own friendship groups, you were seeing some of your friends maybe struggling a little bit more than you two did with that comfort versus cultural pressures, kind of cognitive dissonance.
I feel like everyone was getting engaged at the same time. We don't have much of a, at the same age from different cultures. Everyone's just...
I think most of them got on the bandwagon and just got married early and didn't even really think too much about it. Yeah. We were very late in our friendship group, I think.
Of getting engaged.
Yeah.
Were they pressuring you? Were they like, when are you guys going to get engaged?
I think I got a little bit of pressure, just given that I guess people expected me as the male in the relationship to propose. Did you?
I think a lot of people would ask, do you think he's going to propose? And I always knew that you would. Yeah, I didn't expect you to be proposing to me at a certain time of our lives, whereas I have heard of women say, I want to be proposed to by this year. If not, I'm leaving.
Mm. Yeah. But to come back to Luke's question, I think some of my younger friends now, probably the Gen Zs, the ones that are consciously bucking the trend and choosing life experiences and choosing when they want to get married and if they want to get married and when they want to have kids and if they want to have kids and when they want to travel and if they want to travel and what they want to do before all of that happens more consciously and more deliberately and putting more thought into it than most of our friends and other people in our generation did.
I think our generation was the first to start to explore it, but I do think Gen Z have a lot more freedom.
I'd agree with that.
Absolutely.
Then you did get proposed to, Jack. Did you know it was coming?
I did not. Again, we both have different stories of how it happened, but
I love that.
Of course, Mitch is such a romantic, and we went to stay in the city for the weekend, and he picked me up from my dog industry job, so I was in smelly dog clothes, and we got to our beautiful hotel and opened the door, and I was like, ah, yes, of course, there's rose petals on the bed. Yep, that's Mitchell. And as I was taking my bag off, he's like, oh, there's something else. And I turn around and he's holding a Kinder Surprise and he said to me, you know, will you marry me? And I was like, what the f-?
I'm pretty sure you just started laughing.
I did. And I did drop a couple of what the Fs because I was being presented with a Kinder Surprise. And then I said, Jackie, and he shook it. And I was like, oh my God. Okay. It's not just a Kinder Surprise, it's an egg with a ring in it. Yeah, and then I was walking around the hotel saying, what the F, and then he's like, will you marry me? And I was like, okay, yes. So, yes, I was very, very surprised, yeah. Very happy.
It was the Kinder Surprises that up until then you couldn't get in Australia. There's ones that you could get in Europe, and basically when we had our six-month trip in Europe, she just got obsessed with these, and so I ordered a box of them. And they're like a one with the foil that you can rip off. And so I thought I could actually rip that off, put a ring in it and glue it back down as opposed to try and crack an actual chocolate egg in half and put one in there. So that was a lot easier. And it was a lot easier.
Thanks for that description because I was trying to visualize how you did that with the
chocolate. I'm not magic. Yeah, no.
That day, how did that go for you? Like, were you freaking out?
Probably like Jackie knew that I was always going to propose. I knew she would say yes. It was no surprise. The backstory to it all is probably relevant and made me freak out a little bit. And that's that I had planned this all a month before. We were going to the R&B Fridays concert in Melbourne. And I had booked a hotel room and I had planned it all the same stuff, the rose petals and the champagne and blah, blah, blah. But our friend had passed away probably a week before that, a very, very close friend of ours. And so I was like, we were too grief-stricken. We went to the concert because we had been in tracksuit pants and just in bed for, you know, grieving for a week. So we thought we'll go to the concert just to get out of the house. But I was like, it's not a time to propose. So then I recreated what my initial plan was. And I think that's what made me freak out a little bit was like, oh no, something bad's going to happen again.
Yeah.
Then this is not going to happen again. And I've had this ring now for a couple of months and I just want it on her finger. I just want to get married. I want that something nice to celebrate. And so that probably made me panic a little bit. And then also when she started, dropping the F-bomb and just laughing and running around the hotel room, like kind of leaving me creaking on one knee, I was like, okay, what's happening now?
Are you gonna answer?
Yeah. But the day was quite nice, actually. I had the second half of the day off work, and so I went up early, checked in. I had some time in the hotel myself, and then went and got her, and I had planned what we were going to do after, going out for dinner and drinks and things like that. So that was quite nice, actually. I quite enjoyed the day.
But then, so you got engaged and then you had about 2 years or 18 months before you had your wedding. How was wedding planning for both of you?
I don't really remember. I feel so...
That's because I did it.
You Mitch did it, actually, Mitchell.
Yeah, Mitch did.
This is unusual. This is bucking the trend.
But yeah. I'm a project manager.
Yeah. Mitch is a lot more productive than I. I'm more creative. So I took on more creative roles and Mitch was
I wouldn't agree with that. It was prior to our toddler, I was the organiser in the household.
Yes.
Jackie is very much now the organiser. She's on top of much more than I am. But I have all these templates from being a project manager of how to run an event and how to plan an event. So I just used those.
This is hilarious.
There were printouts on the day.
There were printouts. Everyone got a copy with highlights. Yeah. But our wedding was tricky because we got married outdoors in a forest. And so with that, you don't get staff or a wedding planner or event people. Jackie and I had to organise, you know, what time the florist was going to get there and what time the people that were setting up the arbory were going to get there and what time the people that were going to set up the chairs and the celebrant and the speakers and things. Like all of that, which Jackie or I had to coordinate.
Yeah.
What are you laughing at?
I just think back. I was like, okay, hair, makeup, dress on. I think they were... I was so nervous about all of that.
All of that.
Left you with everything.
It was easy. Guys take 2 minutes to put a suit on, so.
It was a beautiful, looking at the photos from your wedding, it looked beautiful though in that forest, so good peek.
It was a day like today though.
Rainy.
Sideways rain.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yes, we had people call on the morning actually saying, is the wedding still happening today? And we were like, yes.
Bring an umbrella.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we even supplied blankets and extra umbrellas, and it was the most beautiful ceremony. And the sun came out just before we were to say, I do.
Yeah,
it was meant to be, really.
And they do say photos where the rain is happening are the best photos.
We had the most beautiful photos, actually. Yeah.
And to be fair, we didn't get a whole lot of rain. We were in a very dense forest, right? So we were actually quite protected from the wind and the rain. And we had most of the morning where it was drizzly and grey, which is the best for photos. And then the rain really started coming down as we were leaving. So we actually, I don't know, someone was looking out for us.
Okay, we're married now. We've made it there. Did you have a little bit of time to just be married before you started getting those kind of gentle nudges about children, or was that something that came quite quickly after?
So, firstly, I was diagnosed with PCOS in my late teens. So I knew, well, we both knew that it would take a little bit longer for us to fall pregnant. We did have some people ask, it was mainly our parents. We went on our honeymoon, I'd say a year after, and that's when we officially started to try, but it did take us 3 years to fall pregnant. I did have to have a procedure to remove some cysts from my ovaries, and a month after we fell pregnant. So,
oh wow,
yeah, we didn't think it was going to be that quick, but those 3 years though, they were very long years, very emotionally taxing, but we got there.
And probably didn't get too many nudges probably at the start, but then once people knew, I think we were pretty open with telling people, like, we're trying, give us time. It's not straightforward for us. We didn't really get too many nudges, but maybe from the older generations, like Jackie said, particularly, I think on my side, being of sort of Italian heritage, I had some cultural expectations, and Jackie probably had some similar ones on the Greek side. From kind of great-grandmas and things like that, but not so much from friendship groups.
But 3 years is a long time, Jack.
Yeah, it definitely was. We did joke at times that we could have bought shares in the ovulation test. What was that brand?
Clear Blue.
Clear Blue.
First Response.
Yeah, one of those.
If you're listening, we're still interested.
Yeah, there were definitely times where we doubted that it would happen, but the support that we also had for each other was very strong. And, we never gave up.
And also I feel like for some couples where they're a bit lost and they don't know what's next, it can feel a bit more daunting, whereas we were always, we knew what the next thing to try was. Like, we'll try these medicines. If they don't work, we're not going to try them for too long. Then we'll move Jackie onto this. And then if those don't work, then our last resort is let's go in and get those cysts out. And then you probably will be fine after that. And so it was always clear, and it was always sort of implied that it will happen eventually.
Yeah.
We weren't looking down the barrel of you may never be pregnant. Of course, your own internal kind of dialogue does different things to you, and you start to maybe doubt that's going to happen. But I think it wasn't as debilitating as I think some couples have, where it's very much a question of if this is going to happen, and if it is, how, because we don't even know what to do next.
Because that's what I was going to ask. Like, yes, it was 3 years, but knowing it was in the context of polycystic ovarian syndrome, there was an explanation potentially. And was that helpful for you?
It definitely was helpful. When I was first diagnosed, there was no information whatsoever. They just said, it'll be hard to fall pregnant, and that was it. So I had left it probably up until maybe around 28, where I started to take it seriously and be like, okay, I actually need to look after my body, because if I don't, we're not going to get anywhere. I think once I came to realise that I had never ovulated, that really made us seek some advice on what to do, which led to the procedure that removed all of my cysts. And then for the first time in my life, I was able to ovulate and I immediately fell pregnant. So it's pretty sad, the small amount of information on PCOS, because everyone that I know, the first thing they say is, all I've been told is it's going to be really hard to fall pregnant or I won't have children.
Wow.
And what is PCOS?
It's polycystic ovarian syndrome. Yeah, so there are people that, you know, might just have a few cysts or no cysts. They also call them follicles. My obstetrician, he had said that he had never seen so many cysts on ovaries in his 30-year career.
Wowzers.
And that, he said to me, you are going to fall pregnant after this. I just know, like, as scary as it was to hear that I had that many cysts, it was also very exciting to hear that he believed that we were going to fall pregnant, and we did a month after.
Straight away, first time, yeah.
Yeah.
Is the information better now for people who are getting diagnosed, do you know?
It is, but I still feel like a lot of women don't know where to look. I know that there is a clinic, which is a free clinic, specifically for PCOS, but not a lot of people know about it. And I feel like a lot of GPs still don't know a lot about it. I feel like you have to find a specialist, which also does cost a bit of money. So, yeah, I still feel like there still needs to be a lot more awareness and information out there for women with PCOS, because, yeah, I still hear people say, even my younger sister, she says, I have PCOS and it's going to be really hard for me to fall pregnant. And it shouldn't have to be the first thing that you hear.
Because
you can.
You just might need some medical intervention.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
And do you think, just thinking back over our time, we didn't do anything about it at the time because it was almost like, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Like, it was, you found out when you were so young and you were like, I'm not trying to get pregnant now. We'll work out that later.
Yes.
And maybe some encouragement from some professionals at that time to do something about it now might would be good. Or for women who get diagnosed like you did in teenage years or late teens, that some encouragement to get onto it now would be good.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, another thing that women hear about is, you know, changing their diet and exercising. But again, you still kind of need to know exactly what to change in your diet, because it's all so very different. It's a lot of insulin resistance and gluten and dairy and all those little things that really fuel the testosterone, which is a big part of the PCOS. So, yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. I think the more we talk about these types of elements, the more people can get educated on, it's not like the end game. Mm. And there are questions you can still ask.
Definitely.
Coming from a Greek background myself, but also I imagine that it's the same in not only many ethnic, from, you know, different ethnicities and different cultures, but also different generations, the way in which we prioritize certain developmental milestones, say for example, marriage and children, you know, that's something that I have an aspiration for, but it is probably amongst other aspirations also. But in certain generations, that is the thing. Did you find that when you were explaining that you had a condition that would potentially impede on what is like a major developmental milestone, I guess, in our life, did you find that the reaction from your family was a little bit like confused or a little bit tethered to those kind of cultural beliefs? Or did you find they were pretty kind of open and understanding of that? And did that like play on your sense of self-worth as well?
My grandparents are very old school Greeks. They still live in the same area where they migrated, the same village. They're all still together. They still speak very broken English or not even any English. So explaining that to my grandparents, I actually did not even go down that road. I just said, you know, soon, because it was either something brought up, God will help you fall pregnant, or, and myself not being very religious, I was just like, okay. But yeah, I don't think they would ever fully understand about any of that. Yeah, I think it was just...
Is there even a word for PCOS in the Greek language?
I don't know. No.
What about on the other side? Slightly less ethnic, still European background, slightly less ethnic, probably just didn't understand it and looked to you to explain it to them.
Yeah. I think also part of them didn't really, I know it sounds horrible, but they didn't really care enough to believe that my body wasn't able to do it. They were just like, okay, well, hurry up, have kids.
I get it. No real gentleness in compassion. That communication sometimes.
No compassion.
Yeah, and I can relate to having grandparents that, you know, migrated or in this, like my grandparents migrated and they've been in the same house for 40, 50 plus years. And I remember when I started pursuing psychology as a career, there was just no way that I could explain that to them.
No.
I think that they think I'm becoming a doctor. I don't actually know what they think I'm doing at the moment. But
are they putting pressure on you, Luke, to get married?
Not as much as that. My parents, my grandparents are very, very traditional, but it's interesting. I think that they've shifted their views quite a bit because they got married very, very young, straight into the workforce, and not only coming from a very like dirt poor village in Greece, but also coming here and not having as many opportunities. It was mostly like laboring. They now prioritize education a lot. So it's actually my parents that are more the ones that kind of joke and discuss that type of stuff. And when they do in front of my grandma, she actually gets really angry and goes, no, school first, everything else can come after.
Wow. So you fell pregnant. And how did that all go?
It was a very surreal moment for us. And every day was just a blessing. Taking in every moment because, again, we tried for so long and, yeah, just really wanted to make the most of everything. And family was very supportive and, you know, so close. Yeah, it's very different the second time around. Like, you'll be fine.
You're also enjoying the pregnancy a lot less this time around.
Yes.
Well, you also have a toddler that you have to look after at the same time.
Yes.
And so you gave birth to a little girl.
Yep, we gave birth to a very, a very happy little girl. She was just so chill out of the womb, which was good because I went downhill a bit. I have a different story once again to Mitch because yeah. I was in and out of consciousness and had lost quite a lot of blood and had to go into surgery. But, yeah, Miller was just chilling in her little bassinet, which we were very grateful for, but now she's a little psycho.
Full on. Firecracker. Yeah, the Italian and the Greek is definitely strong in this one.
So, Mitchell, what's your take on that birth story then?
I'm quite amazed often by sort of the power of female hormones. I think it's probably a Darwinism thing, but the sort of the flood of hormones that come in after you've given birth, I'm talking over the kind of the preceding weeks or months, just suppress a lot of, I think, the trauma and the thoughts and the memories of the actual labour. And I mean it when I say Darwinism, because I think if a lot of women had proper recollection of what they went through, you know, they probably wouldn't go back for it. And back then, you know, we needed the human race to continue. So Jackie's recollection of the birth and everything is that it was relatively okay and smooth. And I had a very different experience. I didn't have to birth Miller, so I'm not trying to compare trauma, but Jackie, when she says she was in and out of consciousness, she'd lost about 2 liters of blood and was quite close to being, you know, was getting very bad. She was in a bad way. And so for me, the trauma was not about, is baby okay and are we going to, you know, go home with a baby today? It was more like, am I going to lose my person today?
That's full on.
Yeah, and I think we also gave birth in the midst of COVID.
Yeah.
So anytime anything kind of yucky went on, it was like lock down the ward, you know, everyone out of her room and, you know, everyone gowning up and, you know, swab her for COVID. It was quite bizarre. It was a bit Twilight Zone-y. And all we wanted was just people be around her and have eyes on her and make sure she's okay. So that probably complicated things a little bit for us. But so for me, going back for a second, I was kind of almost happy to just stick with one kid just because I didn't want to go back to being in that position of possibly, you know, Jackie not coming out the other end. But, you know, we were assured by the hospital that, you know, it's one of these series of unfortunate events and things like that that, you know, very unlikely that things like that would happen again. But, yeah, it was pretty odd.
So you're feeling okay about birth number two?
I think so. I think we both talked, kind of got some help after and made sure that we worked through that, whatever trauma was there. I think, yeah, it was very short-lived, intense but short-lived, once they kind of took her away and did what they needed to do and brought her back up. They brought her back up to the ward and she was breastfeeding Miller while they were wheeling her in. So I was like, okay, we're good.
All good.
So I'm okay. Thank you, though.
I just wanted to ask, were those complications as a result of your condition or was that something unrelated?
It was something unrelated. I also think during COVID, it was, the labour was a lot slower because there were a lot more restrictions and I think a lot more interventions were pulled out for me, which just put my body in a lot of exhausting pain and stress. And it's weird to say, I kind of blame COVID.
And Jackie wanted to labour at home for a long time with our dog.
Yes.
She's a dog person.
I cried, I think, for the first time since being pregnant, that I wasn't going to be able to labour at home with my dog there. Yes. We know it's definitely going to be different this time. We've had all the support from the hospital and we've spoken about it quite a lot. So, we're not in the midst of a pandemic.
No,
so
you're not.
It's going to be fine.
Touch wood.
Yes.
I don't feel like anything's going to happen in the next 3 weeks, but who knows?
Please, no.
Touch wood. No. Absolutely. I do feel like listening to how you both parent is a little bit different generationally, and I was wondering if you could talk about how you do that.
Firstly, Miller has always double-teamed us from the first day at home. Mm-hmm. So co-parenting is a very big thing with us. We always make sure to help each other out. It's not just you're the mum, you have to do all of that. We always support each other. We do 90% of the time agree on all things parenting. The other 10% will agree to disagree, but completely respect each other's thoughts and opinions. So I feel like we're very strong as a team, and I kind of feel like Miller has kind of done this on purpose, kind of really double teaming us just to see how good of humans we are. For
testing us. Yeah, definitely the co-parenting thing. I mean, we are, that's sort of our relationship just manifesting in a parenting kind of scenario. We tend to typically do things together and as a team anyway, but it's sort of not just our approach, it's also we don't have a choice because she's just so full on that we, like, it's a two-person job. Everything is a two-person job. But I think we also have been pretty blessed by the in a way, contrary to what Jackie said before, we kind of were blessed by the pandemic because I now work from home full-time. So I personally feel quite lucky to have the exposure to everything that most men in kind of generations gone by wouldn't have. They would have been out the door at, I don't know, 7 a.m. and back home at 6:30, and mum would have had to do it all day by herself and would have come home and then done, I don't know, an hour of fun dad playing, and then kids would be in bed. So I'm quite lucky that I've seen it all, and we now have, given that Miller's no longer breastfeeding, because that would be really weird if she was still breastfeeding as a 2.5-year-old, you know, everything's 50-50 down the middle. We each have a day with her each week. We each have kind of nights that we do the routine and the other one has the time off, and it's not a case of, well, you're the dad, you should do this, or you're the mum, you should do this.
Because I know for my generation, and particularly because of the industry I work in, that there are potentially a narrative for men that they're babysitting their children.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's not your narrative. Like, you're co-parenting all in. Was that a deliberate kind of decision choice that you made in your mind, or was that just, as you were kind of talking about, something that came naturally for you both?
Oh, it's so loaded, isn't it? I grew up in a household where I only saw equal parenting, so it was, I kind of just, that's what I grew up knowing. But also I then did a social work degree and learnt about gender and gender inequality and all of those things. And I always knew that I wanted to be a very present, hands-on dad. And then I think we had, in many ways, a blessing in disguise for dads was the pandemic. And the fact that I then went to working from home full-time and have never really returned to working in the office. So I don't miss a lot. And that's good and bad, because it means I have a toddler screaming in the background sometimes when I'm in meetings, but it also means that I can read Miller's cues and read her behaviour and read what she needs just as well as Jackie can, which I know isn't the case for a lot of dads, so I think I'm lucky in that regard. But I do think that I probably get congratulated or patted on the back for like doing average dad things that Jackie doesn't get. You know, when Miller and I, on our day off, if we're at the hospital, not the hospital, the library or the park, I often get sort of vacant, gushing stares and people batting their eyelids at me, sort of thinking, well, it looks like they're sort of trying to impress to me that I'm doing a great thing by being with my daughter and being a good dad. And at the start it was flattering, but now I sort of just get a bit annoyed by it, to be honest, because Jackie wouldn't get that if she went to the park with Miller or was trying to stop her from, you know, pulling library books off shelves. She would be, you know, just a mum being a mum. And so I get a bit over it, to be honest. And I certainly don't need the congratulations, but if I'm going to get pats on the back, then why are we not doing the same thing to mums, is my kind of point on it.
And I think you also talked a little bit about the importance of your relationship with Miller as well.
Yes. So I also, you know, it's not completely selfless. I think I always thought I don't want to be the dad who, you know, my kid falls over and hurts themselves and they run past me to get to mum because they need comfort or they're upset. That would be like a dagger to my heart. So I always wanted to make sure that, you know, our kid just goes to whichever parent's closest because they just see us as both equal in being able to comfort them. You know, in my mind, it was like, if I want 50% of the reward, I have to put in 50% of the effort. Kids are not that forgiving and you can't just buy their love or you can't phone it in. Like, it's literally time spent on the floor playing Lego and it's time spent reading books that's going to get you that relationship. And so...
And listening to Old MacDonald Had a Farm.
And listening to her sing Old MacDonald every night in the bath. Yeah, on repeat. And singing it incorrectly too, which is the worst part. Yeah, that to me was one of the most important things, was being her feeling like she has just two parents, not like a mum who's her mum and a dad who's just this guy who's there, you know, before 7 a.m. and home after 6 p.m. every night. What about you, Jack?
I guess because we've always felt equal in our relationship, I always knew that it was going to be equal parenting and we'd speak about it a lot. And Mitch, you're a bit of a feminist, so I knew exactly what kind of dad you were going to be. But, yeah, it does get a bit annoying when people, they're like, oh, wow, that's just amazing that Mitch has a day off with Miller. It's like, I mean, I have a day off with Miller. What about me?
And the reality is you still had the first, you went back to work at 9 months, right? You still had the first 9 months where you were with her every day.
And is it a day off?
Absolutely not. No.
My God.
It's, yeah, going back to work after a day with her is like, oh, respite, isn't it?
But it is also nice when we are around other dads and you can see them watching Mitch and you just kind of see their eyes kind of light up and they're like, wow, I should really be more like him. I see that quite a bit as well.
Yeah?
Yep. And, yeah, I mean, with this generation, I have seen a lot more parents that are similar, or fathers that are similar to you where, you know, they put in a lot of effort.
Yeah. I think we have a couple of friends in Luke's generation. So it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on it, Luke. But we have a couple of friends in Luke's generation who the dad is staying home for 6 months. Like, mum's gone back to work and dad's doing, like, stay-at-home dad for 6 months. And another friend who's, yeah, got every time, one, or once a quarter or something, has a month off, or, you know, very, very kind of disruptive to the previous expectations. What do you think?
Both you and Jack kind of identified that there's kind of two parts to this. One is social and one is more like structural. So I think that generally speaking, my generation really, really values what you've just discussed as like fatherhood and parenting, Mitch. I think it's so, so important to collaborate in parenting, not only for the child, but also just like it's part of like equality in a sense. And I think that at least in the, you know, around the groups that I interact with, that's kind of a general consensus. And I'm hoping, again, this is all speculation, because structural change tends to be a lot, it's a lot more it's harder to deconstruct, right? I think things like maternity leave, paternity leave, things like that. Again, I'm not super well versed on it, so I'm talking about things that are a little bit outside of my scope, but hopefully with things like the way that we work, how that's changing in terms of flexibility, that will also allow us to kind of, which is, I think, something that's very Gen Z, is work a lot more in a way that is aligned with our values. Because what happens is, even if I think, hey, I want to be at home with my child, but in terms of my occupation, that's not viable, not only is that unfair, but then it ends up actually like supporting those very nuclear traditional beliefs that we're kind of trying to shy away from to begin with.
100%. There is definitely, even in the time since we had Miller to this pregnancy and coming up to this period of leave, there's been changes in the way that parental leave is structured. So essentially now we're entitled to 20 weeks of, you know, leave paid by the government. And previously you could have 18 weeks. Jackie had the full 18 weeks last time. Now she can still have a full 18 weeks. If we want to use the 20 weeks, it has to go to someone else. It has to go to me. She has to share it with me. She can't have a full 20 weeks on her own. If she wants, if it's just her, it's only 18 weeks. If we as a family want to have the extra time, then it hits me. So that's what we'll do. Jackie's going to get back to work in
January
next year. So when our baby's 8 months old, and I'll have 2 weeks off, and that will be the time paid by the government. And we wouldn't get that if she couldn't use it then if she wanted to. She can use hers before that, but it's kind of take or leave the 2 weeks, but only if I want it.
And you're going to have a month off.
Yeah.
When your baby is born, yeah.
Yeah.
One, I guess, final big thing I want to ask for your generation and parenting and family rearing in this day is housing. I know you mentioned before that you have a dog that is the size of a horse. You have a 2.5-year-old toddler and are about to have another baby. What is housing like for you? What are the conversations you guys are having about housing?
We live in a unit, quite a nice suburb. We love the suburb because it's very community-based and lots of young families are around. The only thing is, it's very expensive, and the talk of looking for a bigger house has definitely been on the cards for quite some time. But of course, in this economy, it's become very difficult. We also have spoken to some people that are in a similar boat to us, and something that we have heard, you just make it work. There are countries where, you know, there's multiple families living in a small household, and if they can do it, we can do it. And we really love our place. It's just small in this economy. My gosh.
Yeah.
Trying to afford something is very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if you can afford something, it's completely in a different suburb, away from everything. The house might be run down unless you have millions in your bank account.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I think for us, like, to upsize means to move, basically. And when I say move quite far. And we love where we live, so we're staying put for a while. And interestingly, it was a conversation for me, at least. I don't want to speak for Jackie, but for me, it was a conversation with my nonna who said, described the situation that she was in when she was raising my mum and uncle and auntie, so three kids. And they had left a family violence situation, and they were living in the bungalow, essentially like a granny flat at the back of someone's house. And they didn't even have a toilet in this. It was a one room. They didn't even have a toilet. They had an outhouse that they had to go in all the way into the house to use. And, there was three kids and a lady, my mum, in my nonna, in one bed. And I was just like, it was a penny drop moment for me. And it did make us think, you know, people have been raising big families in small houses since the dawn of time. And like Jackie said, culturally, that your Yaya and Papu's village back in Greece, Luke, they wouldn't have had big places at all, and they would have had lots of kids, I'm assuming. So, yeah, it's a very kind of white, privileged position to think each time we have a new kid, we need a new room for them. So each time we get a new kid, we have to, you know, get a new house. And we thankfully realised that that was a preconception that we had subconsciously that actually, you know, doesn't need to be our story. So we decided we're going to stay, and we do love where we live, and we'll have to move eventually. But yeah, hopefully by the time we have to cross that bridge, the market isn't so scary and expensive. But yeah, we much prefer to have access to the neighbourhood and the friends and the facilities that we have around us than to move far away just to have slightly more breathing space. But we do also have friends in our generation that have looked at buying interstate, buying in Adelaide or buying in Queensland, and staying here, renting and leasing out their places interstate because it they don't pay as much tax and the kind of the overheads to do that overseas, and you have it fully managed by someone in that state, and it's still the return is better than buying something here.
Because we've talked now about a few like developmental milestones, marriage, having kids. Buying a house comes somewhere in between that in many kind of visualizations of life. In terms of like housing aspirations, was that something that you guys ever discussed or was a very large priority to you? And does that still feel like it's something that's viable?
When we were renting and we were like, okay, we want to start a family, our first thing was we want to move to a house that doesn't have stairs. So we ended up moving to a smaller place. And then when we actually fell pregnant, we're like, okay, I think we really need to look to buy for a place, because renting and then having to, you know, move out and find another place with a child is just way more stressful. So I think we definitely wanted to purchase something before we officially had our family, just a bit of security there.
To Luke's point, I don't think housing was a big thing for us. Like, we had friends that were buying houses and like nice houses and then renovating them, and we wanted to travel. I keep going back to that. We just like having the life experiences, and it's not that we didn't want to have our own place, but it was more, I think, a little bit of that cross that bridge later when we get to it, and just travel and have the life experiences now, and then just see what money we have when we want to buy. And we've always been pretty good at saving when we need to, so I think we probably thought we could do that. And yeah, and then like Jackie said, like some stability once we knew we were pregnant, we're starting to really try to have a kid, that we thought we should probably buy a place. But we still weren't really in the market for where we wanted to be. And again, it was just the COVID pandemic that, like, there was a little blip and everything, like the prices plummeted, and we got in just before they skyrocketed and turned the other way and skyrocketed. And so we were just lucky, really. It wasn't really a huge priority for us, I wouldn't say.
Definitely not. I feel like it all happened very fast, within like a month.
Yeah.
We just kind of...
So fast.
We're nudged in the direction of, okay, this is a really good time to buy. Let's do it quickly. And lucky we did, because... Yeah, the prices went up very fast and very quick.
I do feel like that's a generation difference. Like, we're in the same generation, but I feel like my...
Different ends.
My circle are housing obsessed.
Yeah. And that was it housing before marriage?
It's housing definitely before kids. Not necessarily always before marriage, but, yeah, definitely before kids. And I know even culturally for me, so that's like Sri Lankan Indian cultures, often it's housing that's big enough to house your grandparents,
yeah.
Like the parents.
Yeah.
And so I'm often like we live in an apartment. Like, we buck the trend with that. Like, we are not the norm for our generation in the...
Or culture
in the type of housing we live in. But for us, it's kind of similar to you. We value the location more than the size and the amenities and the facilities and that kind of stuff. And I always wanted to get down to only having one car. And so I knew we needed to be near public transport, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But it is the number one conversation we have at dinner parties is housing.
Housing, it comes up a lot. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I think that my friendship group is a little bit more like what Mitch was describing before, where I think that for everyone, there is like this underlying level of like anxiety and like even like a little bit of hopelessness, to be honest. But I also think that there's a huge kind of divide between those who their aspiration is to buy a house, and so that's kind of their main focus, and then those who are doing things like traveling or potentially seeing moving out of state as the right option.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot more, at least, yeah, again, in the circles that I run in, there's a lot more kind of openness to just being like, you know, I'm not really tethered to this place, so I'm happy to move where the opportunity is.
But I feel like we've always made a home out of wherever we've lived. Like, we've had about 6 houses together, and they've been in, you know, the western suburbs of Melbourne, the southeast, the south, all, you know, all over. And it's never really mattered to me so much. This is this place where we are now, the suburb we are now, is the first time we've thought this is where we want to be. And that's why we're kind of investing in making the housing situation work. But we've never been necessarily those people who are like, we're in our forever home at age 23 and we're going to just make this the place that we live forever. And our house, the actual infrastructure that we live in, is really important to us.
I do feel like the location, it definitely has changed. Like when we were younger, we were living closer up the peninsula, so we were close to family and friends, just the lifestyle that we had. Then, as you know, we got a bit older and we wanted to just be in our bubble. We kind of moved away. And now that we have this family, we want to be in an area where it just feels like a community supported with other families. We've always made our home our home. Doesn't matter how big or small it is. We're not very into the aesthetics.
No, we're not pretentious.
We made our small space feel like home.
Mm.
And we just need that small space for us, and we've got each other.
Yeah.
That's all that matters.
Totally.
That's beautiful.
From our time spent together today, but also from what I've heard from Mitch, if I were to describe your relationship, the two of you, I would be describing it with terms like comfort, stability, mutual respect, a genuine love and care and consideration for one another. And you mentioned at the beginning, Mitch, that you felt as though in some ways my generation would be more likely to have kind of non-normative relationship trajectories or age reigns. They wouldn't subscribe to those norms in that way. And I think that one of the reasons for that is to try and attain those things that you guys have together. But in the same way, I also know a lot of people who, and maybe they just met their person quite young, but I think there's also a lot of people that go to the opposite and will get married very early on, and as you said, as just part of the relationship, just thinking, hey, let's have kids, let's buy a house, because in hearkening back to old traditions, that seems to be, you know, well, it was working back in the day. I know people that have been married for 50 plus years. Mm. Clearly, that's the way to achieve those things. Would you guys both individually be able to give an answer to the question of what do you think makes a successful relationship?
Communication. We love to communicate and bounce off each other's opinions, which I think not everyone can do, because we both see each other's sides, and it really has shaped our relationship, and the respect has just grown so much more. Mitch has taught me so many things through communication. And I feel like it's shaped me to be a better person.
Hmm.
So yeah, I'd say communication.
How to follow that? well, also you've taught me a lot of things. And probably same thing, just different word, but I feel like you really have to be open. And I think we learned a lot of that through the pandemic and even just things that have happened since, you know, the referendum and stuff that's happening in America, and just very heated debates in our lives, and going into conversations almost, it feels like almost on a daily basis now, with people who have a very strong opinion on something and aren't even open to being persuaded another way. And there's very few things in the world that I have that strong of an opinion on that I'm not happy to have a conversation and be taught or learn something. And so, you know, there are a few things, but even those few things, if it comes to Jackie, I would be happy to be persuaded another way by her, because I think we respect each other's opinion, and nothing matters more to me than being open-minded to learning something and being converted to another viewpoint, because that's going to make her feel heard. It's going to make me a better person, and it's going to mean we at least have a shared understanding at the end of it. And otherwise, even agreeing to disagree sometimes feels like a bit of a cop-out, because then you're both still going down this trajectory of having different views on something. Communication's a good one, but she stole that. So open, being open, in genuinely open.
Mm. If I reflect back on two words you both used, which I think then comes back to your point, Luke, you said you always knew you'd grow old together, and you said at the point of Miller's birth that it was about your person.
Mm.
And I heard a quote from Esther Perel recently, and she was talking about not all love stories are life stories, and you need to be able to distinguish who is your life story and who is that with. And I feel like you guys have a life story, and it's a very strong life story, and your narrative and the way you talk and share that story with each other is very strong. And so I kind of picked that up a lot in the words you used with each other and then just how you were talking about different scenarios. So I kind of feel like that might be one of your successful elements if you ever get asked that question again.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much for your vulnerability and for your stories and sharing that all with us. And yeah, we've really enjoyed having you on the XYZ Experiment podcast. Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.